Chapter 18. Vranov nad Toplo, April 1944.
Magda? Magda Mella? Is that you?
Magda pulls her scarf around her face. She dips her head to her chest and picks up speed.
Magda Mella, stop where you are!
Magda stops, berating herself. Why did she believe she was invincible when everything around her had gone to hell? She turns round to see the familiar smirk on Vizek's face, her old school friend.
Vizek, what do you want?
Magda is trying to hide the tremble in her voice.
You! We've been trying to speak to you for months, and don't pretend you don't know.
And who is we?
Me and my colleagues in the Helinka Guard, that's who.
My colleagues and I,
Magda corrects him. She hates his smug face, his stupid uniform. He is a little boy pretending to be a man, and he won't get the better of her.
Don't get smart with me. We've come to your house every Friday. Tell me where you've been hiding.
Hiding? Why should I hide? I've probably just been out with my friends. Oh, but that's right, isn't it, Vizek? You wouldn't know what a friend is.
Despite herself, a tiny bit of Magda is enjoying this exchange. It may be her only chance to show him her contempt.
You can't talk to me like that anymore, Magda. I could have you shot, and maybe if I shoot you myself, I'd even get a medal.
Magda has had enough.
What do you want, Vizek? I have shopping to do.
We'll be at your house on Friday as usual, and you had better be there.
It's time for you to join your sisters, don't you know?
He teases, an infuriating grin on his mouth. Magda is alert now, the sniping forgotten. She takes a step towards this man-boy.
Do you know where they are?
Of course I do. I know everything. But Magda hears the hesitation in his voice.
You know nothing, she hisses, because you are nothing but a little boy playing with a big gun. Why don't you go home, Vizek, to your mummy?
Magda turns her back on him and strides off, but she is less sure of herself now. Why hadn't she done as her mother had asked and gone straight home after the shopping? Why had she had to stop by the little boutique on the main street to admire the dresses? She doesn't have any money for a new dress, even if she had somewhere to wear it. Now Vizek knows she is still in Vranov, and that is bad. While she is slamming the few tins of fish she managed to find in the grocery store onto the kitchen counter, Khea comes into the room and watches her for a moment.
What's wrong with you?
Magda ignores her. She doesn't need her own mother berating her too, all for the sake of a dress she will never own.
Maybe seeing your cousins tonight will put you in a better mood,
Khea offers.
My cousins? Your uncle and aunt have invited us to have dinner with them.
Is that because they know we've nothing to eat? Magda snaps, staring at the three solitary tins of fish.
We have food, and haven't you just been shopping?
Look at it, Mama! It's nothing, Magda says. It would have been better for everyone if I had left with Sibby and Livy.
The words are out of her mouth, and it's too late to take them back. Her mother's eyes fill with tears.
Ladies, ladies, what's going on? I can hear you from the garden.
Yitzhak enters the room through the back door.
Nothing, Grandfather, it's nothing,
Magda says quickly. She doesn't need an interrogation right now.
Magda thinks we would be better off without her,
Khea mumbles.
She wants to be with her sisters.
Magda, is this true?
Yes! No! I don't know! But we have so little to eat, and you would have more.
Her grandfather is half the size he was 2 years ago, and he was a slight man even then.
Stop it, Magda. Don't you think we've all had the same idea? How is it helpful?
I'm sorry, Mama.
Magda reaches for her mother's hand.
I didn't mean it, but It's just so hard. How much longer can we live like this? How much longer can I live like this? Hiding, scared of my own shadow, worrying about my sisters. Chaya pulls Magda to her chest, stroking her hair. Some linden tea. That's what we all need, she whispers, and Magda nods.
Maybe Ivan will have some news for us tonight, Yitzhak says, hopefully, as he fills the kettle.
Setting it onto the stove, he stokes the embers beneath to life. There is no wood left, so they will have to settle for lukewarm tea.
Magda, I'll need to collect some more wood tomorrow. Will you help me?
Of course I will, Magda smiles. Later, as they cross the back garden to Ivan's house, Chaya pauses to look at the new buds on the oleander bush. She has tended this bush since she was a child, bringing it back to life time and again. Her family joked that as long as the oleander bush thrived, so would they. It is flourishing now, giving them all a little hope that Sibby and Livy are also flourishing. After dinner, when her young cousins are in bed and the adults are sipping tea around the fire, Magda breaks the comfortable silence.
Uncle, something's wrong, isn't it?
Her uncle has been avoiding her eyes all evening. He gives a heavy sigh and nods.
This is the reason I invited you to dinner tonight. We need to talk.
Ivan places his cup on the small coffee table and lays his hands on his knees. Helena, his wife, is staring at her shoes.
Ivan, Helena, you're frightening me. Please tell me what's going on.
Chaya's hand rests over her heart.
It is no longer the young they are after, Chaya. They are coming for all of us.
A hush falls over the room as this sinks in. Yitzhak slowly gets to his feet and crosses the room to sit beside Chaya.
And where will they take us?
Asks Yitzhak finally, breaking the silence.
I don't know, replies Ivan. No one does. But it's obvious they now want to clear every Jew out of Vranov. Maybe the whole of Slovakia.
He looks at Magda, who is staring at her mother and grandfather, her mouth hanging open. Helena touches Ivan's shoulder and he turns to her, pulling her into his arms.
I can't even protect my own family, he says.
Magda is shocked to see her uncle's distress. He had always been the strong one, never thinking twice about entering government buildings to demand to speak to whoever was best placed to give him information.
Brother, as long as we stay together, we can survive anything, Chaya says softly. It's time for you to stop feeling so responsible for us. None of this is your doing.
Chaya's voice breaks, and she covers her face with her hands.
When will this happen, son? Yitzhak asks.
Magda hears authority in his voice. He is now the strong one.
It could start at any time.
Ivan has adopted the posture of defeat and, like his sister, elbows on his knees, he buries his face in his hands. Helena strokes his back.
We should be packed and ready in any case, she adds bleakly.
Ivan raises his head to look into the faces of Magda, Yitzhak and Chaya. There is guilt and shame in his eyes, and Magda's heart breaks for him. After that, there is nothing left to say, and the Meller family makes their way home. The moment they step through the back door, Magda races to the sideboard in the living room and begins to rummage around in the drawers.
Mama, where are all the photos? She yells. Photos? Now? We just need to get some sleep. Please, Magda, just tell me where they are,
Magda insists. Chaya reluctantly lights a lantern and, with Yitzhak, heads to her bedroom.
I'll fetch them. Mama!
Magda yells once more. Can you bring a pillowcase?
What's wrong with her?
Magda hears her mother ask her grandfather.
How should I know? He says, and she can hear a tiny smile in his voice. She's your daughter.
When Chaya and Yitzhak return with the photos, Magda is brandishing the silver candlesticks, a wedding present that Chaya has vowed never to sell.
What are you doing with those? Chaya demands. Give me the pillowcase and the photos, Mama. Please!
Chaya and Yitzhak watch as Magda folds the items into the pillowcase.
Can you get a chair from the kitchen, Grandfather, and place it beneath the trap door? Magda asks. What are you doing?
Chaya is becoming exasperated. She is tense with worry about what tomorrow holds, exhausted by the thought of what will happen to them all.
Isn't it obvious? I'm hiding our things. Can't we just take them with us? Says Chaya. Do you think they'll let us keep our candlesticks, Mama?
Magda's eyes are bright, determined. Of course, Magda is right, thinks Chaya. Their house is abandoned. Who will stop anyone entering and stealing their things? Not the Hlinka, not the Nazis, and not her neighbours. Let her do this, Chaya, says Yitzhak, dragging the chair to the trapdoor, just as Mrs. Track had done for Magda so many times before. They'll be safe up there.
Yitzhak moves to climb onto the chair, but Magda draws him away. It's all right, Grandfather. Let me do it. I've had the practice.
Pulling herself up, Magda disappears into the tight cavity. Her head appears a moment later, and she holds out a hand for the lantern and the pillowcase.
Mind you're not startled by the mice, Yitzhak tells her, or you'll drop the lantern and set us all on fire.
Magda smiles when she hears a giggle escape her mother's lips. Now, lying flat on her stomach, Magda crawls to the furthest corner of the dark space. Tucking the possessions under old clothes and crumbling newspapers, she crawls away, then eases herself back through the hole.
Now we can go to bed, she announces.
The next morning, mother and daughter find Yitzhak dressed and ready to go out.
Why are you dressed like that? Chaya asks. Aren't we supposed to be packing?
Before we do that, Magda and I are going to find some firewood. I need a cup of tea, and so do you.
Magda is ready in seconds. Yitzhak waits for her outside with a small cart built for the single purpose of gathering kindling. Ever since Yitzhak moved in with Chaya, this has become a regular routine for grandfather and granddaughter, and the moment they step into the dense bushes, with the sun filtering through the leaves, Magda enters her happy place. She remembers the years Yitzhak has spent patiently teaching her the names of every bush and tree, every mushroom and flower. As Magda skips ahead, marvelling at the summer growth around her, Yitzhak scans the forest floor for stray, dry branches. He doesn't mind that Magda has run off into the depths of the woodland. He is just happy that today she is happy.
Grandfather, come and look at this!
Yitzhak leaves the cart and follows Magda's voice to find her sitting by a large oak tree.
I found a flowering sword lily, she tells him.
Magda is cupping the delicate, funnel-shaped flowers in her hands. The glorious purple-pink blooms nod in the breeze.
It's here all on its own, just for us, Magda says, smiling up at her grandfather.
Magda's simple delight touches Yitzhak deeply, but now his mind turns to his other granddaughters. How they would love to be here, he thinks. Sibby, inquisitive as ever, would be scanning the forest for other flowers, refusing to believe the lily was alone. And Livy, he would be begging her not to pick it. Now I know where you hide when you come to the forest at night, my Magda. And what can you tell me about the sword lily? Yitzhak tests her.
They are a genus of the gladiolus family.
And what is the meaning of the word, gladiolus?
It means strength of character, Grandfather. It means never giving up. And it is part of the iris family, which signifies hope.
Magda, initially pleased she is able to roll the answers off her tongue,
now looks away from Yitzhak into the trees beyond. She is thinking about the word hope.
"Strength and hope," repeats her grandfather, "are special secret words. These are the finest qualities a person can have. Qualities I see in you, Magda, and in your sisters."
Magda meets his eyes. He is her protector and her teacher. She is crying now, her tears falling onto the petals of the sword lily. Later, in silence, they pull the kindling-laden cart home, moving slowly, each wondering whether this might have been their last excursion into the forest.
"I was about to come looking for you," Chaya says, as they heave the cart to the kitchen door.
"Magda found a sword lily in bloom," Yitzhak tells her with a grin.
Chaya looks at Magda, who turns away from her mother, still lost to her thoughts. The small living room is strewn with their belongings. Suitcases, clothes, books and non-perishable foods lie in piles on the floor and sofa and armchairs.
"Strength and hope," she says to Magda. "Now I understand the secret of where you have been hiding in the forest."
"Yes, Mama. We will both need these qualities in the days ahead."
"Yes, Mama."
"I'll get the stove going," Yitzhak says, "while you finish packing."
While they are sipping from mugs of fragrant linden tea and staring at the mess around them, the Halinka arrive. They are to report to the train station tomorrow morning. The time has come.
Chapter 19. Auschwitz-Birkenau, March to September, 1944.
Sibby and the other girls working in the post office receive new orders. Handed dozens of postcards, they are instructed to write to the relatives of the family camp's residents, informing them that the prisoners are alive and well, and ask that they send food. Sibby knows these prisoners are almost certainly dead.
"Why are we doing this?" Sibby asks the post office supervisor,
a severe woman with little interest in answering questions.
"You know better than to query your orders. Just get on with it."
That night, Sibby tells Livy of the strange task she has been assigned. She fears that the numbers being sent to the gas chambers are increasing, and wants to know if Livy has heard rumours or read any of the messages she delivers. Livy considers Sibby's agitation. By now she knows that Sibby's work is very different to her own. While Livy just delivers messages around the camp, her sister is confronted on a daily basis by the reality of the death all around them. Hundreds, thousands of letters and parcels are being delivered for the ghosts of the dead. Livy explains that she is careful never to so much as glance at the messages she delivers, not even those without envelopes. It is far safer to remain ignorant, however often she might be tempted to look.
"Keep your eyes open, little sister. I have a bad feeling," Sibby tells her.
The next day, Livy watches the transfer of prisoners, with their possessions, from the family camp to the recently cleared quarantine camp which sits next door. Livy tells Sibby this dark news. And there's more. She also saw a doctor enter the camp and leave with several small children.
A doctor?
A nondescript man in a white coat who is often seen around the camp, trailing groups of very young children, springs to Sibby's mind.
Surely not him.
"I think it was him, Sibby," Livy whispers. Neither of them wants to think about Josef Mengele, or the terrible rumours that follow him all over Auschwitz-Birkenau. 24 hours later, all of the family camp prisoners are dead. The sisters do not speak of it again. They cannot. They hold each other close at night, and each day pray that they will be together again that evening. Spring eases into the summer, and the sisters' routine doesn't falter. They work, eat what they can, and sleep. It is as though they have lived there forever. But while the warmer weather makes their lives easier, It does nothing to diminish their awareness of the crematoria chimneys spewing their ash every morning as they line up for roll call. There is much about the camp they take for granted. The meagre food rations, the stealing, the random beatings. But they will never get used to the smell of the smoke. Part of their routine, an unspoken part, is to ask themselves every day, is today our last day on this earth? The answer comes at bedtime, as they cuddle together for comfort. We survived another day. The trains continue to arrive several times a day, hauling their human cargo into Birkenau. Livy, from her position at the gates, witnesses families from Hungary disembark, only to be marched straight to the gas chambers and crematoria. The trucks trundle their possessions to the Canada. Sibby's new supervisor at the post office, SS officer Elizabeth Volkenrath, treats the girls well, often allowing them to share amongst themselves the food parcels destined for the dead. Volkenrath is young and very pretty. Her long strawberry blonde hair hangs in a single thick plait down her back, and she has blue eyes and full red lips. Sibby notices the other officers staring at her, but she only has eyes for her husband, SS officer Heinz Volkenrath. One morning, Sibby catches him entering her office, and, shortly afterwards, she hears Volkenrath giggling. When Heinz opens the door to leave, he is adjusting his clothes. "We are just married," Elizabeth Volkenrath whispers to Sibby after he has left. Sibby is wary of her apparent openness. This officer has as much blood on her hands as any in Birkenau or Auschwitz, but now she winks at Sibby whenever Heinz visits. He isn't so keen on Sibby, however, glaring at her whenever he comes calling. And Sibby despises him back. One day, she chucks the newspaper he had casually dropped on her desk before entering Volkenrath's office into the small stove in the corner of the room. "Has anyone seen my paper?" he asks, pulling on his jacket after another session with his wife. Volkenrath hovers, smiling stupidly at his shoulder. "I put it down here." He points at Sibby's desk. "Did you want that?" Sibby asks smoothly. "I thought it was rubbish." Sibby indicates the stove. "So I threw it on the fire." Suddenly Heinz is towering over her. "You did what?" he says slowly.
"I put it in the fire," Sibby repeats, faltering a little now.
Without missing a beat, Heinz has pulled out his pistol and aimed it at her head. Sibby shrinks back, her senses suddenly screaming. Gone is her bravado. Gone is her small victory. Now she thinks only of Livy. She has been stupid, cavalier with her life, for nothing. Volkenrath gently pushes his arm aside. "She didn't mean anything by it," she says briskly. "She's a tidy one, that's all." Very slowly, Hans holsters his gun and strides out of the post office, slamming the door behind him. Sibby lets out her breath.
"Don't ever cross Heinz," Volkenrath snaps. "And next time I won't stop him, so be warned."
A few days later, the post office girls attending to a delivery of boxes that have been dumped outside the building. Sibby is helping her workmates sort their contents. She enjoys the rhythm of this work, and she likes Rosie from Bratislava, a new recruit to the small team. Rosie is on her knees, gazing into the box of books she has just opened. She picks them up, one by one, reading the titles. Sibby joins her, noting that many are prayer books. The girls turn them over in their hands.
"What are those?"
A capo has appeared from nowhere. He grabs a book, inspects the title, turns the pages. In seconds, he is hurling the books to the ground and stomping on them until their spines are broken and their pages torn. He is showing off to the SS officers who are lurking close by. That much is obvious. But then Rosie is suddenly on her feet, tall and defiant, cursing the capo, firing words of abuse into his face.
Sibby is convinced one or other of the officers will execute her on the spot, but she is powerless to help. But the capo merely kicks the detritus of the books aside and laughs. An SS officer wanders over to them. "What are you so upset about?" he asks Rosie. "They're just books." Sibby, on her feet now, takes Rosie's arm, trying to pull her away, trying to stop her from digging her own grave. But Rosie shrugs her off. And then Sibby has an idea. "Let me tell you a story," she says, stepping in front of Rosie and towards the SS officer. "One day, the gold asks the iron, 'Why do you shout when you are beaten? I get hit too, but I keep quiet.' The iron replied, 'I cry because the hammer is made from iron. It is my brother, and that hurts me. You are hit by a stranger.'" The officer turns away without a word. The next day, the officer turns up at the post office with a grey box, which he hands to Sibby. She opens it to reveal a prayer book covered in pale grey leather. "This is my gift to you. A good luck omen, so we won't lose the war." He smirks. "We also pray for our enemies," Sibby replies. The officer is staring at her now, his head on one side. "Don't you remember me, Sibby?" he says. "I'm Eric, from the Canada." Sibby wonders why this SS officer would care whether she remembered him or not, but she has given up being surprised by anything that happens in this place. She looks him up and down. "You look thin," is all she says.
"So do you."
"I am a prisoner. You're not." Sibby is feeling bold.
"These days I live off vodka. Food has lost its appeal."
Sibby marvels at the fact they're having a conversation. "Are you sick?"
"Only in the head."
Eric sighs and runs a hand through his hair. He points a thumb over his shoulders.
"Usually I am stationed by the gates, where the transports come in."
He looks at his boots.
"Where they make the selections."
Sibby's curiosity turns to cold, hard, unsentimental fury. Is he expecting sympathy from her? Understanding, even? "Eric, why don't you go and pack your suitcase and go back to your mama?" Sibby says, turning her back on the young man. She is thinking of this exchange, trying to understand why Eric was so keen for Sibby to know he has a conscience, when she sees a little girl standing by the door to the post office. The mailroom is next to the hospital block, where Mengele houses his children. Too many times, Sibby has witnessed his shiny black car pull up outside and disgorge the unremarkable man, along with the little girls and boys. She has watched him herd the children through the doors of the hospital, joking with them as he hands out sweets. Sibby has no idea what happens to those children exactly, but it can't be good.
"Hello,"
the little girl says. Sibby takes a step towards her, aware of the SS officers lingering close by.
"Hello," Sibby says hesitantly. "My name is Sibby. Do you have a name?" "Irinka." "That's a beautiful name, and you're a beautiful little girl."
Irinka smiles shyly and opens her mouth to say more when a nurse approaches.
"There you are. Come along now, Irinka. You know you're not meant to be outside."
The woman's tone is sickly sweet.
"Bye, Sibby,"
the little girl says, taking the nurse's hand. Sibby's stomach turns as she watches the little girl disappear through the hospital doors. The fresh air feels cloying suddenly, the sun a furnace. Sibby hurries back inside the post office, where Vulcanrath is patrolling the room. Sibby can see she is in a good mood.
"What's going on with the children in the hospital?"
Sibby asks nonchalantly, as she pulls a stack of letters towards her. She begins to open them methodically, noting down the names and addresses of the would-be recipients.
"If they're in the hospital, then they must be sick," Vulcanrath replies.
"They don't look sick, or act sick," says Sibby lightly.
"Well, they are. I've been on the wards and they are all in bed.
Some of them are definitely receiving treatment.
Sibby nods, acknowledging she won't get anything more out of Vulcanrath. Maybe it's better not to know. Maybe it's better they're in the hospital. Most of the children arriving in Birkenau these days are sent to the gas chamber immediately.
Can I tell you something?
Vulcanrath moves closer, and Sibby's skin crawls.
Heinz and I want to have a baby, begins Vulcanrath in a low voice. That's why he's always here. I cuddled some of the younger ones next door, and there was this one little girl. She can't have been Jewish. She had beautiful blonde hair. Do you know what she asked me?
Sibby shakes her head slowly.
She asked me if I had an egg. She wanted to eat an egg. That's strange, isn't it?
Vulcanrath's voice is wistful, and Sibby finds this intimacy disturbing. A few days later, Sibby unpacks a box of food and finds a hard-boiled egg. She thinks of the girl who wanted an egg and takes it into Vulcanrath's office.
Look what I found, she says.
Vulcanrath doesn't look up.
What?
It's a hard-boiled egg. You said there was a little girl. Vulcanrath is out of her chair in seconds, holding out her hand for the egg.
Thank you. I'll take it to her straight away.
A short while later, Vulcanrath storms back into the post office and heads straight for her room, slamming the door behind her. The girls glance nervously at one another. Sibby takes a deep breath and decides to find out what has happened. She opens the office door very slowly and peers inside. Vulcanrath is sobbing, her head on the desk. Sibby enters the room and pulls the door closed behind her.
Are you okay?
She asks hesitantly. The officer sniffs loudly and looks at Sibby. Her blue eyes are red and her cheeks bright pink. Strands of blonde hair have escaped their braid and stick to her face in damp clumps.
No, she says, I am not okay.
Was she not there? Sibby asks with genuine compassion.
She was there. I found her and handed her the egg.
So that's good, isn't it?
She started screaming and wouldn't take the egg. Then she ran away and hid behind one of the nurses. She wouldn't even look at me.
Vulcanrath begins to cry again.
Oh.
Sibby feels somehow responsible and suddenly very anxious.
I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have given it to you. It's not your fault. Now leave me alone.
The officer turns away from Sibby, wiping her eyes with her fingers. Sibby shuts the door behind her and turns to face her watchful co-workers, all of them waiting for an explanation.
You know she wants a baby. I think she gets upset when she sees the little ones, Sibby offers.
She waits all morning for her punishment, but none comes. Vulcanrath appears a little later, her usual grim smile back on her face.
Have you heard?
Rosie whispers, later that same day. The girls in the post office mostly work in silence, opening boxes, sorting contents, setting aside items of value. Sibby can lose herself in these tasks. She can almost forget where she is at times.
Heard what?
Sibby says, distracted.
About Marla, the interpreter.
What about her?
Another girl asks.
She escaped.
Rosie is gleeful. She has Sibby's full attention now.
She and her boyfriend, Edic, have escaped together. They've been gone for days. How exciting is that?
You're sure? Sibby is trying to make sense of the word escape.
To flee this place. To live without fences, without beatings, without the guards.
She doesn't often let herself think of her life before Birkenau. The camp has expanded to stifle her memories of a different time, and she rarely imagines life after the camp.
The Nazis are going crazy,
Rosie informs them.
One of the girls who works in the administration block told me they're all blaming each other to save themselves.
I hope she makes it.
Sibby says quietly. I hope she makes it and can tell the world what's going on in here.
She dares to allow a small flicker of hope to ignite. The girls are animated that night. Sibby and Livy, their hunger and fatigue forgotten for a moment, engage in the joyful speculation about Marla's escape. Marla, the talented translator from Belgium who had been assigned protected prisoner status by the Nazis. The girls guess she must have used her freedom from the constraints the rest of them have to endure to somehow get away. She is a hero to every prisoner, and stories of her bravery escalate as the weeks pass. They hang on to the fantasy that they will be saved once Marla has revealed the truth of their situation. But the weeks become months, and there is no Allied rescue. The transports from Hungary arrive each day. The gas chambers and the crematoria function morning and night. No one mentions Marla's name anymore. One September evening, after everyone has returned from their various work details, they are instructed by the SS officers to gather in the assembly yard. Organized into long, semicircular rows, they form a horseshoe shape around a central clearing in which something, obviously, is about to happen. Livy, standing beside her sister at the end of a row, hopes an announcement is to be made. She prays that they are not about to be punished, or forced to watch a punishment. But it is still a shock to the sisters when Marla, naked, filthy, thinner than ever, is marched into the clearing by SS officers and shoved to the ground. Bloodied and bruised, the young girl staggers to her feet, standing as straight as she can manage, a defiant tilt to her head. Livy finds the tiny knife in her pocket and closes her fingers around it.
"Oh, Marla," she says under her breath, "what have they done to you?"
And then SS officer Mandel steps into the compound. Her high ponytail catches the setting sun and glows red. Livy thinks she could be anywhere between 40 and 60 years old. Livid patches of rouge on her cheeks make her look like a clown. She is not on her horse today, but she is no less intimidating as she begins to strut up and down the rows, berating the girls furiously, telling them to forget about escaping, that they are wasting their time even thinking about it. Look at Marla. They had found her, hadn't they? And they would find any girl who was stupid enough to test them. There was no corner of the earth that the Germans could not cover. Marla wasn't so clever after all, was she? She and her boyfriend, Mandel spat this word from her mouth, had been recaptured so easily. He was being hanged right at this very minute. But Marla wouldn't be so lucky. Hanging was too good for Marla. She would be burned alive. While Mandel is raging in their faces, she doesn't see what is going on behind her, what every other prisoner is now witnessing. From the matted remains of her dark hair, Marla withdraws a small blade, which she drags along the length of her arms from wrist to inner elbow. Into the eerie silence between Mandel's outbursts, she lets out a low moan and collapses. Mandel spins to find her prize lying on the ground, blood gushing from her arms.
"She is not to die like this," she rages. "She is to die by fire."
An officer runs into the clearing with a wheelbarrow. Mandel points at Livy and another girl.
"Load her in and take her to the crematorium. Now!" she screams.
"Let me go," says Sibby, grabbing her sister's wrist. But it is too late. Livy is moving past the girls into the clearing.
With the other prisoner, Livy heaves the emaciated, bloody body of Marla into the wheelbarrow. The girls each take a handle and began the journey to the crematoria. Marla is barely conscious, moaning softly. Two officers walk a short distance behind them. Once outside the women's camp, on the road heading towards the crematoria, the girls slow their pace. The SS do the same. Without exchanging a single word,
The girls have acknowledged that they will let Marla die in the wheelbarrow. She is quiet now. It shouldn't take long. They walk slowly, staring straight ahead, aware that Mandel might appear at any moment. As they draw closer to the crematoria, Livy looks at Marla. The girl's face is relaxed. Her eyes are open, staring blankly up at the sky.
"She's dead," Livy whispers.
"Good." Two male prisoners are standing at the entrance to the crematoria when they arrive. They stare at the girl in the wheelbarrow, before wheeling her away without a word. The girls walk in silence back to the camp. Chapter 20. Vranov nad Toplo, September 1944. Yitzhak is dressed in his finest suit, a white shirt and tie, clothing totally unsuitable for a hot, late summer's day, but he would not be seen in public in anything less. Chaya wears her simple, functional black dress. With tiny buttons from collar to her midriff, the dress skims her calves, and a black belt cinches her slim waist. Her hair is in a red and gold scarf. After all, she is a proud Slovakian woman, and these are the colours of the traditional folk costume. Chaya tucks her black stockinged feet into her sturdy shoes and throws a coat over her arm. There was much discussion between mother and daughter as to what Magda should wear. They are going on a train journey and they don't want to be uncomfortable. All that sitting around required some preparation. In the end, Magda wore a plain blue skirt and a collarless blouse covered in blue and yellow flowers. She decided against stockings, but insisted on wearing her best shoes, slingbacks with a silver buckle. She also packed some sensible shoes. Magda refused the scarf Chaya pressed on her. She wanted her hair to be loose and wild. "All the better for holding my head up high," she told her mother. A small suitcase carried by each of them, they leave the house. Magda turns to lock the door, but Chaya calls out, "Don't!"
"Don't what, Mama?" "Don't lock it. It's a lovely door, and I would hate for it to be broken." "Of course, Mother is right," thinks Magda. "And didn't she hide the candlesticks? Their photos. They are hated by this town. These neighbours would think nothing of breaking down the door to steal their things. Don't underestimate them, Magda. They mocked your sisters on the day they were taken from me. They will race each other to our door once we've gone." Chaya's eyes alight on a figure further up the road, Mrs. Cherny, leaning on her gate, watching the Mellers.
"She is one of them," hisses Chaya. Yitzhak has been watching this exchange in silence. Now he picks up Magda's suitcase and hands it to her. "Magda, put the key in your pocket. Maybe the neighbours will steal from us, maybe they won't. A locked door will not stop them." He puts his arm around her shoulders and draws her close to him for a moment. She can hear his heart beating, slow and steady. Magda takes in a deep breath, and finally, with a last look at the only home she has ever known, she joins her family as they begin their reluctant march up the street. Mrs. Cherny looks away as they pass. Chaya keeps her eyes on the road ahead, but Magda cannot hold her tongue.
"If you step foot inside our house, I'll find out, and then I will come back and curse you and your entire family."
"Magda, please," says Chaya, taking Magda's arm, urging her on.
"Leave her be, Chaya," snaps Yitzhak. "She is only saying what we're all thinking."
He doesn't look at Mrs. Cherny, but spits on the ground as he moves past her gate. Mrs. Cherny's eyes narrow, but she holds her tongue. Magda is glad her mother is gripping her arm so firmly, otherwise she would be tempted to slap the smug look off the woman's face. The rest of their journey is in silence, each lost to their thoughts. Will they ever see these landmarks again? The church, the linden tree. The station is heaving with friends and family they have not seen for many months. They share stories of hiding, of bribing government officials, of selling everything they own but the clothes they stand in. Many are overjoyed to see each other, believing their friends had long since been abducted by the Nazis. The guards are checking off the names of everyone on the platform. Many receive no response. Magda shivers each time this happens and prays that they are safely in hiding.
"The Kovacs haven't answered," she whispers to her mother. "But I saw Mrs. Kovac in town last week, so I know they're still here. Maybe we should have tried harder to hide."
"Hide where?" asks Chaya. "Sooner or later they will find the Kovacs, Magda. And what do you think these monsters will do when that happens?" When the roll call is over, they are ordered to board the train.
"But where are we going?" a voice shouts.
"You'll find out when you get there," comes the terse reply.
Yitzhak, Chaya, and Magda squeeze together on a double seat in a crowded carriage.
"It's better to be squashed against someone you know," Yitzhak tells them with a smile.
Magda, by the window, watches the river Topla speed by as the train picks up pace. In the past, the river was the natural border between the town and its invaders. She has crossed it only a few times, most recently when she went to the hospital in Umene, the time she was saved and her sisters weren't. She doesn't look back as the river disappears from view. She doesn't need to. She will return. Magda sees the rolling hills of the countryside, green pastures, forests, and then the stunningly beautiful Tatra Mountains, more rivers, a lake. She whispers to herself the names of the towns they pass through: Poprad, Ruzomberok, Zelina. The train changes track, and an hour later they stop at Novaki. The guards scream at the passengers to disembark. While some of the elderly need help, Yitzhak doesn't. He strides down the aisle and offers a hand to Chaya and Magda as they climb down, as any gentleman would do. They are relieved to be outside, in the fresh summer air. Magda yawns and stretches. The prisoners are marched down the length of the platform and onto the street, where the locals of Novaki have gathered to gawp.
"For shame," Yitzhak mutters.
Magda begins to understand the true nature of what lies ahead of them when some of the prisoners refuse to go any further, insisting on knowing where they are being taken. The Halinka guards draw their batons and lash out, regardless of age or gender, violently herding the crowd forward. The subdued crowd falls into a heavy silence, a silence composed from despair, thinks Magda. The Mellas hold hands. They can't lose each other. They have already lost too much. They move towards what is obviously a school at the end of a street. Play areas and chalked concrete denote children's games, but there are no children in the building. They are led into the main hall, all glossy floorboards and climbing frames, and from there divided into smaller groups and allocated classrooms. Magda gazes around at the tiny chairs, forgotten pencils, dusty desks. At the front of the room, mathematical equations are scrawled on the blackboard. Their guard informs them that this is where they will be spending the night, so to get comfortable. Yitzhak immediately finds them a space along the wall. Everyone does the same, as the guard watches, a glint of amusement in his eyes. With their backs to the wall, they sit down and stretch out their legs, staking their claim to whatever floor space is available.
"There are toilets and washing facilities outside. Someone will take you when it's your turn," the guard says.
"What about food?" Yitzhak asks.
"I'm sure you all have food in your cases, old man. Why don't you eat that?"
the guard snarls, before turning his back on the room and shutting the door. Yitzhak and the other men in the room get to their feet and head to a corner of the classroom to talk in hushed voices.
"What was that about?"
Chaya asks when Yitzhak returns.
"Typical," he sighs. "Everyone has a different plan, and no one can agree on which to implement."
Magda's eyes blaze.
"We must do something, though, surely."
She can't seem to rid herself of her hatred of the Halinka guards, some of whom Sibby was at school with. These old friends of hers, striking the old men and women with batons.
Some want us to stay put and see what happens. Others want us to break down the door, beat the guards and run away. And a few want to barter their way out of here.
And you? What do you want to do? Magda persists.
What can I do? I have no money to buy our freedom, and I am too old to fight.
He meets Magda's eyes.
I can't risk doing anything that might hurt you or your mother.
So we wait. Is that what you're saying?
Magda knows her anger isn't very useful, but she can't help it. She wants to spit and kick and punch.
I want to fight, she says vehemently. Don't even think about it,
Chaya snaps. Magda abruptly stands up and walks away. She doesn't trust herself to say another word on the subject. Magda weaves her way in and out of legs and bodies, towards her friend, Susanna, who she has just spied on the other side of the room. Susanna gets to her feet as soon as she spots Magda approaching, and the girls find a couple of chairs, out of the earshot of the adults. They talk animatedly about the miracle of their survival, how they escaped the Shabbat abductions, how their families managed to endure the ever-diminishing rations of food.
To begin with, they sent me away, Susanna tells Magda, to our non-Jewish relatives on the Ukrainian border.
Why on earth did you come back? Magda asks, incredulous.
They weren't very kind to me. They had a farm, and it felt like I was the only one doing any work. I felt like a slave, Magda. But that isn't the reason I left. They'd heard that anyone caught sheltering Jews would be deported, so they sent me home.
Susanna had been back in Vranov only a couple of weeks. That first night in the classroom is hot and uncomfortable. Before they settle down, the conversation is focused on food, how much they should eat and how much they should save. Yitzhak produces a pocket knife and rations their bread, cheese, dry biscuits. One by one, everyone else does the same for their families. Magda is relieved to be allowed outside the next morning, but her mind is on more than fresh air. In the small playground, she finds that two other classrooms have also been released. Magda and Susanna join a group of teenagers.
I say we attack them,
one boy says, squaring his shoulders.
And when we're free in the streets of Novaki, what do we do then?
Susanna asks. No one has an answer for that.
It's funny, muses another boy. School always did feel like a prison.
Nothing has been resolved between the teenagers by the time they are shepherded back into the classrooms. Another day and night passes in a fog of ignorance as to what lies in wait for the prisoners, and Magda's class becomes despondent. In the afternoon of the third day, a Halinka guard hands around rations of bread and coffee. From her suitcase, Chaya takes out a jar of pickled vegetables to mask the taste of the stale loaf. She shares it with the other families until the jar is empty. They endure two long weeks of confinement, with little change to their routine. They are fed twice a day, allowed to exercise for an hour, and the rest of the time they are locked into their classrooms. All talk of rebellion abates after a couple of men who demand an audience with those in charge never return to their families. By the end of the second week, Magda has lost track of the days. This is how they break our spirits, Magda thinks. But then, one morning before breakfast, a guard enters the room. When everyone is silent, he glances at his clipboard and calls out,
Magda Mela, identify yourself.
Magda, Chaya, and Yitzhak stand up.
Wait, you're not all Magda Mela, he snaps.
I'm Magda. This is my mother and grandfather.
Then tell your mother and grandfather to sit down.
What do you want with her?
Says Yitzhak, standing in front of his granddaughter. That's none of your business, old man. Now move.
We go where she goes, Chaya insists. She's my daughter.
The guard gives a nod of his head to some guards in the hallway, signalling for them to come inside.
It's all right, Mama, Magda says as they approach. I'm sure I'll be back soon. And save some of that delicious bread for me.
She winks at her mother, but Chaya grabs hold of Magda's sleeve, pulling her away from the Helinka guards. Magda pats her mother's hand and gently removes it. She can almost hear the bristling tension in the limbs of these boys and doesn't want to test them.
Mama, please. I won't be long.
Chaya, please come away. Now.
Yitzhak's eyes are fixed on the guards. They are seconds away from striking her. He knows it. He leads Chaya back to their chairs.
Don't forget to save me some bread,
Magda calls with a grin. Her heart is hammering so hard she's amazed she got the words out. She waits for the classroom door to close behind her before she rounds on the guard with the clipboard.
What do you want with me?
You'll see,
is all he says, leading her along the hall towards the back of the school and into the administration block. She enters a large foyer where several other teenagers, mostly girls, are also waiting. The guards abandon them to their fear for 2 hours. The room falls into silence, insurrection forgotten. Eventually the guards return, 5 of them, and the teenagers get to their feet. Whatever is about to happen to her, she will find out right now.
You will go with my men, says one, presumably their leader, and you're to leave immediately.
Go where?
A boy asks. The guard fires back the usual answer.
You'll find out when you get there.
What about our families?
Magda has finally found her voice. She thinks of her mother and grandfather pacing the small classroom, waiting for her to return.
They will join you later. Enough questions. In the schoolyard, I want you to line up and wait for my instructions.
You can't do this, explodes Susanna. You can't separate us from our families.
Make some trouble. I dare you,
the guard says, and your family will pay for it. When the room falls silence once more, the guard nods once.
Good. Go.
The schoolyard is empty, but glancing up, Magda catches sight of faces pressed against the classroom windows. She doesn't see her mother. Parents call out to their children as they're led out of the school grounds and away. Magda recognizes the route they're taking. They're heading back to the train station. I was right, she thinks glumly, as they are led onto the platform where a train idles on the tracks. She has never felt more alone. Is this what Sibby and Livy went through? Did they feel abandoned and terrified? Of course they did. Cold sweat seeps through her thin blouse as she boards the train to watch the town of Novaki disappear. Magda jolts awake as the train grinds to a halt. How long has she been asleep? The memory of being separated from her mother and grandfather rushes in, and the hollow pit in her stomach growls. They have arrived in the city of Banská Bystrica in central Slovakia. Once again they're on the march. The midday sun beats down on them. Once more they find themselves in a school, in small classrooms.
Do you think they will feed us?
A girl asks when the guards have locked them inside.
I'm starving.
I'm sure they will, placates Magda. The last thing they need is to become hysterical.
I don't have any other clothes with me,
another girl says.
None of us do, says Magda. We're all in the same boat, so let's just sit down and get comfortable.
It is dark when the guards return to take them to the toilets, after which they are fed stale bread and coffee. Magda hopes to sleep now she has something in her stomach, but the bread feels like a rock in her tummy, and the coffee has left a sour taste in her mouth. The despair she sensed in the crowd as they march towards the first school now washes over her. She stifles her sobs, but around her no one is making the same effort. Eventually, exhaustion overwhelms her, and Magda falls asleep to the sound of girls crying. 2 toilet breaks, 1 hour of exercise, and 2 meals a day. The same drill as Novaki, but its familiar routine brings Magda no comfort. One night, Magda dreams of streets filled with Hlinka guards, fighting with the townspeople of Vranov. Jews and non-Jews alike battle the men for the sake of the town, for the end of Nazi tyranny.
"You need to get out,"
a voice tells her, and then says it again, louder. But Magda wants to fight the guards. She's not going anywhere. Her eyes flick open. She isn't dreaming. A figure hovers in the doorway, saying the same words over and over.
"You need to get out."
Magda sits up. Everyone is on their feet now, disoriented, alarmed. What is going on? The stranger is a big man, with dark curly hair that hangs in damp coils around his face. He has a cut on one cheek, bloodied knuckles. He is sweating profusely, breathing hard.
"All of you, come on! You need to run!" he yells,
waving at the girls to start moving. Magda is instantly alert. This is what they've been waiting for, she realizes, to be rescued. The girls shove and push each other out of the way as they scramble for the door. Magda enters the schoolyard just as the first faint rays of sun announce a new day. She stops for a moment to take in the chaos unfolding around her. Young men with Hlinka rifles and batons charge through the crowd of teenagers, urging them off the school grounds into the town beyond. Magda reaches for the arm of a man. "Where do we go?" she asks.
"Anywhere. You're free now. Don't you realize what's going on? We're taking back our town, this country."
"Who are you?" shouts Magda as the noise of girls crying, men shouting, and guns firing intensifies.
"Resistance fighters," he yells back. "Word came through last night to begin our attack. This is happening all over Slovakia right now."
With that, he disappears back into the crowd. Magda looks around for Zuzana, for any familiar face, but it is chaos. On the street, she runs in the same direction as everyone else. Shop windows are smashed, cars overturned, a bullet screams by her ear. Magda stumbles into a small alleyway to avoid the gunfire. It is a dead end, with a large, foul-smelling dumpster parked outside some double doors at the end of the alley. She tries a handle, but the doors are locked. The noise from the street is getting louder. Men are shouting. Are they Hlinka or resistance fighters? She has no way of knowing. Magda hides behind the dumpster. Curled up on the ground, hidden from view, she stays there until night falls. Whenever she creeps up the alleyway to peek out, the same scenes of chaos play over and over. People running in all directions, men and guards fighting with fists, with guns and knives, women still crying, screaming for help. Some have suitcases, some have pushchairs loaded with either babies or possessions. Don't they know where to go? Magda wonders as she crawls back to the dumpster and allows sleep to overwhelm her senses. The next morning, it is quiet. Magda watches the street for long minutes, but no one passes, and finally, with a deep breath, she decides to leave the alleyway. There is their prison school at the end of the road, and abruptly she turns to walk in the opposite direction. Rounding a corner, Magda finds herself on a large main road, and she is no longer alone. A German tank powers towards her, followed by armed soldiers marching alongside a large canvas-covered truck.
"You there! Hold your ground!"
The soldiers raise their guns, and Magda stumbles as her head begins to swim. She holds onto a wall for support, and an image of the dumpster flashes through her mind. If only she had stayed put. Was it all for nothing in the end? The guards fire questions at her, barely waiting for her answers. "Magda Mela," she replies. I'm from Vranov. Yes, I'm a Jew." And then she finds herself being led away, a captive once more to the truck. Pulling aside the canvas flaps, a guard nudges her in the ribs with his rifle.
"Get in!"
The truck follows the tank, stopping every so often to take in new prisoners. Soon it is full. Magda's companions are men and women and children. All of them have the same terrified, exhausted expressions. Magda realizes her own face is a mask of theirs. The truck speeds up now that its hold is full of cargo. When she pulls back the flaps, she sees two German military vehicles sailing along behind them. There will be no escaping this time. They reach their destination in the late afternoon. This is no empty school. She hears the whine of iron gates creaking open before the truck pulls up and everyone is ordered out. The sun is still shining, but it's losing some of its heat. Magda is grateful for the cool breeze. Razor wire runs along the perimeter of the high concrete walls of the compound. Large four-story concrete buildings surround a central clearing. Everything is grey.
"It's a prison," a woman gasps.
A prison guard approaches, and to Magda's horror, he is pointing at her.
"Step forward, miss," he commands. "Welcome to Ilava Prison."
The officer smiles from ear to ear. "Your little insurrection has failed.
The German army will not be defeated by a rabble of untrained freedom fighters. You will now be our guests until we decide what to do with you."
He turns away from Magda to another guard.
"Take them to their cells. But her," he points at Magda, "she is to have a cell of her own."
The second guard grabs Magda's elbow to lead her away, but she shrugs him off. He is taking her towards one of the grey blocks. Inside, the cavernous, echoing space is a hive of cells, metal walkways, and fetid air. Magda is placed in a tiny room on the ground floor. As the door clangs shut behind her, she inspects her cell. A wire bed with a thin mattress is pushed up against one wall. A steel toilet without a seat is in the far corner, and there is a small table and a chair at the head of the room. She can almost touch both walls with her fingertips when she spreads her arms. Instead of processing where she is and what will happen to her, Magda lies down on the lumpy bed and loses herself to sleep. Hours later, the sound of a heavy key turning in the lock startles her awake. Magda is not ready for this, whatever this is. But it's just a guard with her dinner, which he hands over without a word and leaves. She stares at the stew with its indistinguishable brown lumps and the half loaf of soft bread. For a moment, the sight of the food banishes all other thoughts. She eats fast, not tasting the stew or the bread, and it is over all too soon. This is the most substantial meal she has eaten in days, in months. The sun has set, and the lights in her room suddenly go out. For a moment, she is in complete darkness. It is then, as her eyes begin to adjust, she turns to the narrow window above the desk to see the moon. Magda feels her way back to bed. The next morning, after another good meal of sweet porridge and more bread, she places the chair on the table and ascends the rickety structure to look out of the window. From this position, Magda finds herself staring directly into the exercise yard below. She hears whispered conversations, but can't make out any actual sentences. One of the inmates catches her eye. He looks familiar, very familiar. "Excuse me," she calls, thumping the window. The man stops, looks around.
"Up here. I'm at the window."
"Hello up there," he says with a smile.
"Are you Mr. Klein from Vranov?" she asks.
He looks surprised and his smile grows wider.
"I am."
"And who are you?"
"Magda Mella. You were my maths teacher. You also taught my sister, Sibby. Don't you remember me?"
"Magda, of course I remember you. But what are you doing here? Is Sibby here too?"
"No, I'm alone. And I don't really know why I'm here."
Magda spies a guard advancing on Mr. Klein and she ducks.
Move along. Or do you want me to help you?
Threatens the guard. Look after yourself, Magda. I'll be here tomorrow. Mr. Klein throws over his shoulder. Now Magda has something to look forward to. For the next 3 mornings, she has a brief exchange with Mr. Klein. He makes her laugh with stories about Sibby's behaviour in class. She knows he wants to cheer her up, because she has told him about what has happened to her family. He can shed no light on what will become of either of them. On the fourth day, Magda finds herself being marched out of the block, with no breakfast and no warning. In the prison courtyard, now thronging with hundreds of other inmates, Magda waits her turn to climb into one of the trucks. Those who show the slightest sign of hesitation are encouraged with a swipe of a baton or the butt of a rifle. It isn't far to the train station, maybe half an hour, and when they reach their destination, instead of carriages with seats, Magda and the others are ordered into cattle wagons. Inside it is stiflingly hot, and it stinks. She has no water or food. No one does. For the entire journey, Magda alternates between shutting her eyes, praying for sleep, and looking for Mr. Klein. In neither case, she is successful. The journey takes the whole day, and the sun is setting when the prisoners are ordered out of the wagons. Magda leaps down before she is pushed, and lands not on the platform of a station, but onto train tracks. Powerful lights overhead illuminate the scene. Hundreds of people surround her. Some have suitcases and bags, as if they're visiting family. Dogs bark as they strain on their leashes, hungry for something. Maybe our blood, thinks Magda, dazed by the lights and faint with thirst. And then she spies the emaciated figures in the blue and white striped uniforms, darting in and out of the crowd, snatching the belongings of the prisoners.
Schnell! Schnell!
New soldiers scream, and Magda knows this German word.
Faster!
Where are we? Magda asks, catching the eye of one of the thin men.
Welcome to hell,
he says, his eyes darting back and forth between the prisoners.
Where is hell? Poland. You are in Birkenau.
And then he is gone.